I teach a New Testament class every spring semester, and the class covers the entire New Testament from historical Jesus on up through the book of Revelation. And I begin the class by talking to the students about one remarkable life. So this is the life of a man who lived 2,000 years ago, who was born and raised in a remote part of the Roman Empire. Before he was born, his mother had a heavenly visitor who informed her that her son would not be a normal human, he'd be the Son of God. And he was born miraculously. As a young boy, he showed that he was far superior to his elders in knowledge of all things religious. When he became an adult, he left home and engaged in an itinerant preaching ministry, traveling around, teaching people that they should not be devoted to the material things of life, but they should be devoted to their spirits, their spiritual realm. He gathered a number of disciples around him who were convinced that he wasn't a normal human being. He was, in fact, the Son of God. And their belief in him was confirmed by the miracles he did. He could heal the sick. He could cast out demons. He could predict the future. At the end of his life, his enemies trumped up charges against him. And he appeared before the Roman authorities on trial, but they weren't really able to harm him. At the end, he ascended to heaven, and he came back from heaven to convince his followers that, in fact, he was still alive. Some of these followers wrote books about him. But I don't think many of you, maybe any of you, have actually ever read any of these books, and I doubt if you know whom I've been talking about. I've been referring to the famous pagan philosopher Apollonius of Tyana, a Pythagorean philosopher who lived in the first century, about the time of Jesus, and who, like Jesus, was thought by his followers to be the Son of God, to have been born miraculously, to have engaged in miracles, and at the end of his life, to have ascended to heaven, from which he occasionally would appear to his followers afterwards. Now, when I tell this story to my students in the Bible Belt, I'm lucky to get out of there alive. but the reality is that even though for my students, Jesus is the only miracle-working Son of God they've ever heard of, in the ancient world, Jesus was one of many miracle-working sons of God. And it's this idea of being a son of God in the ancient world that I want to be the topic of this talk. Because Jesus and Apollonius of Tyana were not the only two. There was competition, by the way, between Jesus and Apollonius of Tyana. Apollonius was born probably a few years after Jesus died, and so they were not strict contemporaries. But a few centuries later, there were pagans who were saying that Apollonius is the Son of God, and Jesus was a fraud and a magician, and the followers of Jesus were saying that Jesus was the Son of God, and Apollonius was a fraud and a magician. There was a competition between these two, but they weren't the only two. There were other people in the pagan world who were sons of God. I should pause for a second. Those of you who have heard me before know that when I use the term pagan, I'm using it in a historical sense. Historians use the term pagan to refer to anybody who's not Jewish or Christian, basically. A pagan is anybody who accepted any of the many polytheistic religions of the ancient world, which means 93% of the population. So when I use pagan, I don't use it in the way that we might use it today when you say that your next-door neighbor is a real pagan, whether he is or not. So So when I talk about pagans, I'm not saying anything derogatory. I'm just talking about people who are polytheists, which was almost everybody. Well, as I said, Apollonius and Jesus were not the only two people who were seen to be sons of God. There were lots of others, and there are stories told about these others. that are in many ways similar to stories that were told about Jesus. These stories include stories of their miraculous deaths. It was often thought that people who were uniquely divine, humans who were divine in some sense, typically had something happen at their death which was unusual for the rest of us when we die. For example, the founder of Rome, Romulus. Well, there are stories that go back in the ancient historians such as Livy that show that there were people who thought that Romulus, the founder of Rome, did not have a natural death. According to these stories, Romulus, near the end of his life, had called a Senate meeting, and the senators had all come together in an open place, and a huge storm cloud appeared, and fog dropped, and when it lifted, he was no longer there. And the senators said that he, in fact, had been taken up to heaven, and that he was, therefore, both God and a God who came from the gods. Romulus was accepted as a divine being, and so he became divinized. He started out as a human, but by being taken up to the realm of the gods, he became divine, and Romans from then on actually worshipped him in the name Quirinius as one of their chief gods. So he had a miraculous death. Julius Caesar. When Julius Caesar was assassinated, his nephew, Octavian, who became Caesar Augustus, declared him to be divine, that he was, in a sense, God. And at his funeral, there was a comet that appeared that lasted for 7 days, and the people said that this was his soul going up to the heavens. That's what the comet was. It was, of course, to Octavian's advantage to say that his adopted father was God, because if he was the son of Julius Caesar by adoption, that meant that he, by the nature of the case, was the son of God, which, of course, was useful for his own propaganda. The Roman emperors were often divinized. The Senate voted and decided that, in fact, this person had been a god. And often it was associated with miraculous deaths. We have accounts of people living miraculous lives. And so not just emperors and politicians, but also philosophers were thought sometimes to be able to do miracles. They would be able to do things that the rest of us can't do. For example, healing people, sometimes even raising the dead, and so on. We have accounts of people from antiquity who had miraculous births. I've mentioned Apollonius of Tyana is a pretty remarkable instance in which it was thought that his mother was visited by a god who said, she said, who's my son going to be? And this god said, it's going to be me. He was going to be her son. So when he got born as a human, she is an incarnation of this god. One of the most interesting stories about the birth of a divine human is the account told of the birth of Hercules, or in Greek, Heracles. So I don't know if you all are familiar with this story. It's actually told in several versions in antiquity, the funniest of which is in the comic playwright Plautus. I'm not sure if you all are familiar with Plautus, but he's a great playwright. And I, for most of my adult life, refused to read Plautus. And the reason was that my brother did his PhD dissertation on Plautus. And I thought that if my brother liked him, he couldn't be all that good. But my brother kept telling me how outrageously funny he was. And I went ahead and started reading Plautus. And in fact, my brother was absolutely right. It's terrific. So Plautus has a play called The Amphitryon that talks about the birth of Hercules. So Amphitryon is the name of a main character in this play. Amphitryon is a general in the army who's been off fighting a war. And before he has gone off, he has gotten his wife, Alcmena, pregnant. So he's off fighting this war, and Alcmena is back home. And before she starts really showing signs of being pregnant, Jupiter, the king of the gods, looks down and sees her, and she's gorgeous. And Jupiter, as you know, has a thing about gorgeous women. And so Jupiter comes down and appears to Alcmena in the form of Amphitryon. And so she thinks it's her husband come back from war. And she welcomes him with open arms. And they go to bed. And Jupiter gets everything he wants. In fact, it's going so well that he orders the constellations to stop moving. In other words, he stops time so that he can prolong this just indefinitely, which he does. And then finally, even Jupiter gets his fill. And then orders time to resume. Time resumes. Next morning, Jupiter goes back to heaven, satisfied. And as it turns out, Amphitryon comes back from war that morning and doesn't understand why Alcmena is rather cool towards him. She just thinks she spent a very long night in his arms. And so this is not like it. As it turns out, Jupiter got Alcmena pregnant, even though she was already pregnant from Amphitryon. Now, obviously, there are some problems with anatomy and biology and all this, but they weren't worried about that. She gave birth to twins. Hercules was the son of Jupiter, and Iphicles was the son of Amphitryon. And so she had twins, one of whom was divine and the other who was mortal. How is it that you can have human beings who are not simply human, but are also divine? How does that work? So in order to understand this, we have to understand how ancient people, especially pagans, thought about the divine realm. Because the way ancient people thought about the divine realm is not the way most people today think about the divine realm. In the modern view, there is a very broad and deep chasm between humanity and divinity. Humans are one thing, and God is something else. And there is a huge chasm between being God and being human. So, you know, it's an unbridgeable chasm, basically, for most people. Because we are so puny and finite and mortal, and God is none of that. God is eternal and all powerful and all knowing. Well, that's a modern view that ancient people didn't have. Ancient people did not think about the relationship of the divine and the human in terms of a broad chasm. They thought of the relationship of the divine and the human more as a continuum. A continuum of life. The way I illustrate this with my students is to compare it to what I call the divine pyramid. This is a kind of view that you get among ancient people, among ancient pagans. Many pagans, especially those who are philosophically inclined, thought that there's one God who's sort of the head honcho. There's one God who is the superior God, and some pagans thought that there's actually one divine being who is the original divine being. And so this one is at the very top of the pyramid, this God, whatever he's called, whether he's Jupiter or Zeus or someone else, or even an unknown God that we don't even know what his name is. Below that God, there were the great gods. These are the gods that we learn about in Roman and Greek mythology. In the Greek mythology, you get Zeus, and you get his wife Hera, you get Apollo, you get Ares, the god of war, you get Aphrodite, you get the gods of Mount Olympus, who are extremely powerful and immortal and far above anything above us, but they're not the supreme god. Now, pagans also believed that there were other gods that I'm calling here just by abbreviation, local divinities. You have gods of all sorts of places and all sorts of functions in the ancient pagan world. You get gods of forests and streams, god of the ocean, god of a meadow, god of the homes, god of the hearth, gods of various places where these gods have power, and gods of all sorts of functions. So you have gods of war, gods of health, gods of climate, gods of childbirth, gods who are in charge of a wide range of things, just virtually everything that we're involved in. You have divinities that that are active in them. These local divinities would include family gods. Every family has divine beings that they regularly worship. The whole idea of this polytheism is that there's not just one god that you ought to worship who is far beyond the rest of us. There are lots of gods, and they all deserve to be worshipped. Because pagans thought this, pagans, as a rule, were highly tolerant of one another. There was no sense in paganism that there's only one right religion. There wasn't any sense of that at all. There are lots of right religions, and you should participate in any and all that you want to. Participating in one did not exclude you from participating in another. This is another way in which ancient pagan religion is very different from religion today. I mean, today, basically, if you're a Mormon, you really shouldn't be a Buddhist at the same time. And if you're Roman Catholic, you're not going to be a Hindu. Muslims aren't fundamentalist Christians. I mean, these are, you sort of choose something. But in the ancient world, it wasn't that you had to choose something to the exclusion of something else. If you decided that you wanted to worship Aphrodite, Zeus didn't mind. Of course you should worship Aphrodite. She's a goddess. But that doesn't mean you have to stop worshiping Zeus. You see, it's much more fluid. In most cases, much more tolerant. Below these divinities, you have a group of divine beings that are called daimonia. These are not exactly like demons the way Christians Jews eventually thought about demons. These daimonia are lower divinities that are not as powerful as these others, but they have more to do with you. They're around more often, and they have direct effect on your lives. And they're kind of divine spirits. It's another way to translate this name. Christians ended up later saying these daimonia, in fact, were demons. They were evil. But the pagans didn't think of them as evil. Some could be evil. Some could be good. But they were just a lower form of divinity. Below the daimonia is a group that are divine humans. Divine humans are human beings who are also, in some sense, divine. And so some of these people that I've been talking about, they're not just mortals like the rest of us. They are superior beings who are, in some sense, divine. At the same time, they're human. And below these divine humans, there are humans. Where does the emperor fit into this? Well, as I pointed out, the emperors were often divinized. The emperors were worshipped throughout the Roman Empire. They were worshipped as a god. But when the emperors were worshipped as a god, it's not that people thought that the emperor was this god or one of those gods. The emperor was down here. The emperor was a divine human who, since he was divine, deserved worship. And worshipping the emperor was actually a way of making a political statement that you agreed that the gods had empowered the state through their key representative, the emperor, and so the emperor would be worshipped by performing sacrifices to him the way other gods were worshipped. And so worship of the emperor fit in very much with this. Were Jews an anomaly in the ancient world? So you get these other peoples who are worshiping divine men and thinking that people are men are divine, but you might think, well, maybe Jews are different because Jews are monotheists and they do believe there's a big chasm between God and humans, and so aren't you know, don't they really fit into a kind of a different category? And the answer is yes, and some, in many respects, that's true. The Jews are different. But, you know, asking what Jews believed in the ancient world is kind of like asking what Jews believe in the modern world. I mean, which Jews are you talking about exactly? So it's not, we have this tendency to think of ancient Jews as this monolith, like all Jews were the same, and all Jews believed the same thing. And, it, you know, in reality, on the ground, it just didn't work that way. Many Jews, in fact, held to a view kind of similar to the divine pyramid that I mapped out for you. Remember, Jews think not only is there like a God up there and us down here, there are angels and archangels and seraphim and cherubim and principalities and powers, and there's all sorts of divine stuff between God and us in for many Jews. Not only that, but there were Jews who thought that there could be divine men. As a case in point, the Jewish philosopher Philo. Philo was a Jew, a very prominent Jew of the first century, who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, who was heavily influenced by Greek philosophical traditions, especially by Plato. He was an intellectual. He probably was not a typical Jew, but it's hard to know what a typical Jew was. You have different kinds of Jews. Well, Philo wrote a book on, he did a kind of a biography of Moses. This biography is largely based on what he would have read in the Hebrew Bible, or in his case, he'd be reading the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. But he filled it out and put his own touch on his understanding of who Moses was. And for him, Moses wasn't just a mortal like everyone else. So let me just read you a couple of excerpts, just a couple sentences, where Philo says, "There are other people whom God leads higher, preparing them to soar above every species on earth, to position them near himself. Such a one was Moses. This is what is indicated by the fact that when Moses was about to die, he was not added to his fathers like the other patriarchs, but he was bodily removed from earth to heaven through the Word. That is, through the same Word by which the entire universe was created." So, you know, you have that tradition in Deuteronomy where you know, Moses dies, but nobody knows the place they put him, and so like nobody knows where his grave is. Well, for Philo, in fact, it didn't work that way. God actually took him out of the world by his word, the word that created the universe. The word when, for example, when God said, "Let there be light," there was light. God speaks a word that creates the universe. That word lifted Moses up to God's realm. From this you may learn that the God who works in all things considers the wise man to be worthy of honor equal to the Word itself. For not even when God permitted Moses to associate as alone to earthly creatures did he confer upon him merely ordinary virtue. Rather, he elected him to be God and leader. God made Moses a god. Well, that's very similar to what pagans would be saying about divine men in the pagan world. I think it's very important to realize that Jews living in the Roman Empire were parts of the Roman Empire. And many Jews in the Roman Empire were thoroughly infused with the thinking that was prominent throughout the empire. They're not just a people apart who have everything off to themselves, living by themselves, thinking their own thing. They're completely influenced. Many of them are completely influenced by other things. And in that, they're, again, it's not all that different from our own cosmopolitan society. All right, so I've been mapping out for you the divine realm and divine men. What's it all got to do with Jesus? Scholars since the end of the 18th century have debated what Jesus really preached. This debate is predicated on the assumption shared by scholars that the Gospels of the New Testament may contain historically accurate information, but they also probably contain information about Jesus that is not historically accurate. One reason for thinking that the stories about Jesus in the New Testament Gospels may not all be historically accurate is that there are discrepancies among these stories, contradictions, both in detail and in overall portrayal. John's portrayal of Jesus is very different from Mark's portrayal of Jesus, and it's very hard to reconcile those two. It is almost impossible to reconcile many of the details, many of the factual statements, and even the overall portrayals are at odds, which means that if we're going to use the Gospels to know what Jesus said and did, and by the way, there's no option to that. If you want to know what Jesus said and did, you have to restrict yourself to the Gospels because it's our only pieces of information. And they probably do contain historically accurate information. But if you do use the Gospels, you have to be critical about it. You can't simply accept that when this verse says this, that's how it really happened, because they're at odds with each other. So if you've got multiple witnesses to a crime and these witnesses all disagree with one another, you've got to figure out where you can trust which ones. And that's what you have with the Gospels. You have to figure out how you can trust, where you can trust which one. And so scholars work on this all the time. They've been doing it since the end of the 18th century. There's no unanimity among scholars on these issues. Since a century ago, when Albert Schweitzer wrote his famous book, The Quest of the Historical Jesus, the majority of scholars in Europe and the United States, the majority of scholars, except for fundamentalists and conservative evangelicals, the majority of everyone else has thought that Jesus is probably best understood as an apocalypticist. By apocalypticist, I mean that he was the kind of Jew, like the Jews at the Dead Sea Scroll community, who believed that this world we live in is controlled by evil forces. And that's why there's so much pain and misery in the world, because there are cosmic forces aligned against God, for example, demons, but also forces leading to natural disasters, the devil, that there are evil cosmic forces that are running this age now that we live in, which is why this age is so rotten. I mean, look around. You've got hurricanes and tsunamis, and earthquakes, and drought. There's famine. There's war. There's abject misery. And it's not God's fault. Well, then why is there all this? Because there are forces of evil that are bringing this onto the earth. And according to these apocalypticists, these forces of evil that have been unleashed against the earth are going to be taken out of the way. God is going to intervene and overthrow the forces of evil and bring in a good kingdom on earth. The time is very near when God will intervene to destroy the forces of evil and get rid of the wretched kingdoms that are making our lives miserable now. This happened in the last election, by the way. Sorry. God is going to intervene, overthrow the forces of evil that are causing, and the wicked kingdoms that are in charge now, to set up a new kingdom, a kingdom of God on earth. My contention is that Jesus had a very similar view to this. It's a view found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's a view that John the Baptist had. I think it's a view that Jesus had. In Jesus' own preaching, Jesus preached that there's going to be a cosmic judge sent from heaven to destroy the forces of evil. Jesus called this figure the Son of Man. He was referring to a passage in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, where one like a Son of Man is given the authority over the entire earth and destroys the wicked kingdoms that are causing such havoc here on earth. Now, one reason that we could spend an entire week talking about Jesus' proclamation is because it would take about six of those days to talk about Jesus' teaching of the Son of Man. because it's a very complicated subject. Jesus talks about the Son of Man a lot in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And scholars have to decide which of these sayings are ones that go back to Jesus himself. Part of the complication is that Jesus sometimes talks about himself as the Son of Man, and other times seems to talk about some other figure that he calls the Son of Man. When he talks about this other figure as the Son of Man, it's a reference to this cosmic judge who's coming to destroy the forces of evil. So scholars have to decide which of these Son of Man sayings is Jesus using, and my contention is that when Jesus talks about the Son of Man, the historical Jesus, I mean the man himself who was walking around in Galilee, when he talked about the Son of Man, he was talking about this cosmic judge who's coming on the clouds of heaven in reference to Daniel chapter 7. Jesus thought there's going to be a judgment day brought by the Son of Man in which he would destroy the forces of evil and set up a good kingdom on earth. People who have sided with evil in this world and have prospered as a result. Okay, the 1%. When people prosper by siding with the forces of evil, they shouldn't think that they're going to die and get away with it. God's going to raise them from the dead, and they're going to face judgment. God will raise them from the dead, and they'll face judgment. On the other hand, people who have been poor, who have been downtrodden, who have been oppressed, who've suffered injustice, who have experienced enormous pain and misery in their lives, those people are going to be exalted because they're on the side of God and they're suffering because the forces of evil are oppressing them. And so the Son of Man is going to bring a destruction, he's going to bring a resurrection, he's going to bring a reversal, and there's going to be a good kingdom that comes on earth. And Jesus thought this was going to happen within his generation. Truly I tell you, there are some of you standing here who will not taste death before they see that the kingdom of God has come in power. I think Jesus actually said something like that, Mark chapter 9, verse 1, or Mark chapter 13, verse 30. Truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away before all these things take place. Like other apocalypticists, Jesus thought that the end was going to come within his generation. His followers, in my opinion, thought, some of his followers thought, that Jesus himself would be made king of that coming kingdom. It's Jesus' proclamation that's indicating that the kingdom is soon going to come. And Jesus told his disciples that they, the 12, would sit on 12 thrones ruling the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, who's going to rule them? Jesus chose them. Jesus is their leader now. Will Jesus be their leader then? If so, he will be the king. And what is the king of the future kingdom of God? The king of the future kingdom of God is the Messiah. I think Jesus thought, or I think his disciples, some of his disciples thought that he would be the future Messiah when the kingdom comes and the Son of Man arrives. This expectation that Jesus might be the future Messiah was completely shattered by the fact that when Jesus went to Jerusalem the last week of his life, he got arrested by the authorities, was put on trial, was unsummarily tortured and crucified. They executed him. People thought that he might be bringing in the kingdom, but instead he got squashed by the kingdom that's in power now. Rather than overthrowing the Romans to set up the kingdom of God, Jesus, in fact, was destroyed by the Romans. This must have had the most unbelievable effect on the disciples who had hoped that he would be the one. And it brought into disconfirmation everything that Jesus had ever said for them. I don't think you can emphasize enough the enormous disappointment that must have come about and the terror that must have come about among the disciples when Jesus suddenly was crucified and dead. But, as you know, that's not the end of the story. As a historian, I don't think I can know what really happened after Jesus' death in its details. I certainly don't think that a historian can demonstrate that Jesus really was raised from the dead. I think there are things that we can say that everyone can agree on, whether they are a Christian believer or not. I myself am not. I'm not a Christian. I'm an agnostic. But I think we can say some things about what happened that led Jesus' followers to reverse their reversal. Their beliefs in Jesus were radically disconfirmed by his crucifixion, but then something happened that turned it around, and what happened is they came to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. They came to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. I think that's a historical certainty, that some of Jesus' followers believed he got raised from the dead. Now, I'm not saying that he was raised from the dead. Obviously, I'm not a believer. But some of his followers thought they was raised from the dead. I don't know that we can say that all of his followers thought that. We don't have record from all of his followers. In fact, none of these disciples left us any writings. So we have to go on the basis of what other people tell us. But one of the people who early converted to Christianity was the Apostle Paul, who was not one of the disciples. Paul definitely believed he saw Jesus alive after Jesus' death, probably a couple years later. Paul tells us that both Peter and James claim to have seen Jesus alive after his death. So what I think is this. I think that Peter, James, Paul, and maybe more, I don't know if there are more, had some kind of visionary experience where Jesus showed up to them. Now, I'm not saying Jesus really did show up to them. He may have. If you're a Christian, you say, yes, he did. If you're not a Christian, you say, no, he didn't. I mean, but everybody can agree that they thought that Jesus appeared. So these last couple months, I've been reading up on visionary experiences. It's really interesting. There are a lot of people who have visionary experiences. I don't know if you saw Oliver Sacks has just come out with a book on hallucinations, where people, hallucinations where you have a visionary experience and there's nothing there to cause it. You're just, it's in your head. But people who have hallucinations think that there's somebody actually there. So when it comes to Jesus, I mean, either they thought something was there or there really was something there, and the difference between those two is the difference between a believer and a non-believer. But people have visions all the time. Especially, for example, people have visions of those who've recently died. A loved one who dies not infrequently shows up to see you, either in a dream or when you're awake. And typically, when somebody has that kind of vision of a recently deceased loved one, they think it's real. And they can actually touch the person and give them a hug and a kiss. And sometimes the person shows up to more than one person at once. It happens. I mean, you know, psychologists, of course, have a field day with this, and there are all sorts of, you know, theories about all that, but it certainly happens. My point is, these disciples, I think they had an experience of a recently departed loved one, and they interpreted it that Jesus is alive again. These disciples were themselves apocalypticists who thought that life after death will be a bodily existence, and they thought that Jesus had entered into that bodily existence. His body had been raised from the dead. And once they came to think that, it changed everything. Jesus came to be transformed by the belief in his resurrection. So the way I think it happened is Peter has a vision of Jesus. Okay, either Jesus really shows up, if you're a believer, or he just has a vision, if you're not a believer. Peter has something. He interprets that Jesus is really there. He's convinced he's no longer dead. He's convinced he's been raised from the dead. But it's not just that he sort of came back from the dead and he's now going to be around for another 30 years before he dies of old age. When Jesus is raised from the dead, God raises him from the dead and takes him up to heaven. And what happens when somebody goes up to heaven? They're divinized. These early Christians thought that the Son of Man was coming from heaven in judgment on the earth, and now they think that Jesus is in heaven. What do they think? They think that Jesus is that Son of Man that he's been preaching about, the cosmic judge of the earth who comes from heaven, who is a semi-divine being. Jesus is suddenly not just the preacher we were following that we were hoping would be the Messiah, he's the Son of Man, who's going to be coming on the clouds of heaven soon to judge the earth. And so Christians begin talking about Jesus as the coming Son of Man, which is why in the Gospels you have Jesus talk about himself as if he's the Son of Man, because those are the words that his followers put on his lips, because they think he is the Son of Man. And so they alter his sayings so that now when he talks about the coming Son of Man, he's talking about the Son of Man, which is himself now. Jesus is the Son of God. In all of these pagan religions that I've talked about, when somebody is divinized, when somebody goes up to heaven, they are adopted by the gods to be a divine son. The earliest Christians thought that when Jesus was raised from the dead, it was God adopting Jesus to be his son. In ancient Rome, an adopted son often had a higher status than a born son. If you were in the Roman aristocracy and you wanted to decide who would inherit all of your property, all of your dependents, all of your clients, all of your status, all of your power, you would adopt somebody to be your son. And if you had a natural son, your natural son would be below the adopted son. So it's the opposite with us. Many people today think that an adopted person is sort of on a lower status than a born person, but in the Roman Empire, it's the opposite. These Christians thought that Jesus was adopted to be God's son at the resurrection. And the more they thought about it, the more they started pushing back the time at which Jesus was adopted. In the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Mark, Jesus gets adopted at the baptism. You are my son in whom I am well pleased. That's the point. He becomes the Son of God. So he's not just the Son of God at the resurrection now. He's the Son of God for his entire public ministry at his baptism. In Matthew and Luke, Jesus is born the Son of God because his mother is a virgin and God gets the mother pregnant. So that Jesus is the Son of God not just for his public ministry, but for his entire life. When you get to the Gospel of John, Jesus pre-existed his birth. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So you see, what you get is a backward push. It starts with the resurrection, that's when God adopted him, then it goes to the baptism, that's when God adopted him, then it goes to the birth, he's born the Son of God, and then it goes to eternity past. By the time you get to the Gospel of John, you have talk about Jesus as if he himself is God. I and the Father are one, says Jesus in the Gospel of John, and only in the Gospel of John. Before Abraham was, I am. In the Gospel of John, only in the Gospel of John. Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. In the Gospel of John, and only in the Gospel of John. As time goes on, Christians start talking about Jesus more and more in divine terms. So he becomes a divine human, and eventually he becomes God himself, who becomes flesh. Ultimately, then, that's how we get to Jesus as God.